welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show, we are talking about Rob Zombie's Three from Hell, which recently had a limited Fathom Events release and did so well that it's back out tonight for one night only before it hits VOD and streaming. So this is a little bit of a different kind of an episode because, you know, we're usually talking about movies that are in, you know, wide release or at least limited release, you know, normal theatrical release, not something like this that just gets these weird one-offs. But I think as the industry continues to change, we're going to end up covering more movies like this, more of these weird one-off release kind of things. I know, of course, we've got Jay and Silent Bob later this month, which we'll probably do an episode on. But we got a fun conversation for you today with two returning co-hosts. Again, another one of these three-person episodes. These are a lot of fun to do. They're a lot more work to actually organize and make happen, but they can be a lot of fun when we make them happen. We've got Joe Black and Adam Wells joining me today, who both are very well-versed in the world of horror and Rob Zombie and had quite a lot to say about this movie and its influences. So it's a really great conversation. I want to remind you all to make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. And of course, join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we always have lots of great conversations about all these movies we talk about on the show. So, let's get into it, this conversation about Three from Hell. All right, so Three from Hell, this is take two. We had a little bit of technical difficulty getting this one recorded the week that it had the Fathom Events screening, but you know, it all works out because it's actually back in theaters for a day today that we're putting this up, we're going to talk about it. With me, we've got two great returning co-hosts. We've got Adam Wells and Joe Black. How's it going, guys?
Hey-o! What's going on, people?
Hello, everyone. I'm doing well. Thank you for asking. How are you, David?
Oh, I'm good. Just fitting in lots of podcasts. I mean, this has been the craziest month. There's so many movies out and so much coming out, and it's a lot to talk about, but I'm loving it.
I'm still waiting for your Zeroville podcast. That's the one I want to hear.
You know what? I make such a big stink about watching movies in theaters, you know, and it actually did open here for 1 week at one theater, and I didn't make it there.
Oh, man. Well, don't feel too bad. It did the same thing here in L.A. It was only here for one weekend in L.A. at one theater, and it was terrific.
Okay.
Yeah, I loved it. Yeah, you got James Franco making out with Liz Taylor's handprints at the Chinese theater in the opening credits. You know you're in for a good time.
Oh, boy. Well, maybe I'll finally get around to it. Three from Hell, you guys. I know that the both of you are pretty big fans of Rob Zombie and his whole, like, filmography, right?
That is an understatement, yes. He's my favorite contemporary filmmaker.
I've definitely watched all of his movies multiple times. I own several of them. Some of them I like more than others.
All right.
Yeah. I think that when he's sure of what he's doing and when he's in full control, that's when you get the best results. So I'm actually not the two films of his I'm not nuts over are Devil's Rejects and Halloween. And I think it's because Devil's Rejects, as much as people like it, that's one of his few films where you could tell he didn't quite know what he was doing, that he was like figuring it out as he goes along. Mm. And then with Halloween, you can see the interference of others. But in everything else that he's done, even House of a Thousand Corpses, his vision is so sure. And he's working on such interesting thematic level. I love him. I'm so grateful for him being in the mainstream.
I think that's an interesting thing that we should start on before we jump into some puzzle pieces here. The Devil's Rejects being kind of, you know, it's part two of this trilogy. And you're saying that is, you know, one of the weaker entries, that he's like finding his footing kind of there in that middle place. Like, where do you think he always, from House of a Thousand Corpses, was like moving towards this kind of a story?
No, I don't think so. I think that House of a Thousand Corpses, I mean, he had been directing music videos for over a decade at that point. And so what did he do? He made a film that functioned as a long music video.
Totally.
You know what I mean? But in a good way. I think that it's a very sure of itself movie. There's nothing in that movie by accident. And I just think it's brilliantly constructed, and he did that as his way to break into movies. But then when it came time for round two, he had to make a real movie. And while, you know, it, overall the movie is successful, Devil's Rejects, I still think it's a good movie. It's just not quite to par with some of his other work. I think that it, you can actually see him like figuring out what he likes to do visually, figuring out how he likes to string a scene together, how far is too far with the performance, how dialed back, you know, it's very experimental. And then from then on, the rest of his career, his films are so sure of themselves and so, and more thematically driven than story driven or even plot driven, you know, and that's why I think that horror fans maybe aren't so hot on him, because I feel like he actually makes films that are horrific. He makes films that are not, they're not fun horror movies. A big example I use is like at the beginning of Scream, when Drew Barrymore is hanging from her, you know, her own intestines in a tree, and the camera zooms in on her mother screaming, and we get the beautiful Scream title card. That's fun to watch. But yeah. In Halloween 2, when Brad Dourif comes home and his daughter has been butchered and her blood is covering the bathroom so heavily that it looks black, and he just sinks, and Rob Zombie cuts all the sound and cuts to slow motion, but not at slower frame rate. So there's a jarring quality, and he just, like, that's painful to watch. There's no fun in that. There's no joy in that. There's no excitement. And I think that that's why he's not quite a horror favorite. You know, he's working on in a different way, not a better way or anything, but a different way.
See, I'm glad you brought up Halloween too, especially that sequence, because that is probably the best sequence that he's ever directed. Just performance wise, editing wise, shot wise, like, you just feel for Brad Dourif's Sheriff Brackett in that moment, the pain, the anguish. It is a very difficult sequence to watch, especially from a character in the first movie where he was very generic, and they really turned him into a very heartfelt character in the sequel.
I agree.
For a great character actor, but that to me is probably the best sequence he's ever directed and edited.
I do think that it's an incredible scene. I just think it's an incredible film all around. I flipped a coin, but I almost got a tattoo that just said Halloween 2 2009, because that is my favorite horror film. I actually wrote an entire book on the film, because I was amazed to see a horror film that was about violence and the effects of violence on someone's psyche, both violence in entertainment and violence that they have either inflicted or that has been inflicted upon them. That's what the whole film is about, and how the film is actually not about good guys and bad guys. It's literally about evil. Evil is a spiritual concept. I think that film is thrilling to watch. And that's the first time where he had all the money he needed and was left alone. Because he
asked. So do you think Three from Hell is a book worthy movie?
No, I don't. Okay. But I do think that it is, full of wonderful themes. I mean, it's no accident that you've got, you know, blonde hair, blue eyed Sherry Moon Zombie wearing a Native American headdress while shooting an arrow through a Mexican wearing a luchador's mask. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, he's saying some things here, you know what I mean? But I don't think that it has that kind of cultural significance that Halloween 2 did. And I also feel like this movie, more than the rest of Rob's movies, is kind of about him. More than anything.
Sure. Yeah. Well, we'll get into a bunch of that, I'm sure, as we're starting to go into some puzzle pieces. But why don't we go with you, Adam, first for your first puzzle piece?
Okay. So my first puzzle piece, I think the biggest influence of the three movies is obviously a movie within the Texas Chainsaw Massacre universe. However, I'm going to say the 2017 Leatherface as a puzzle piece, even though I think it in itself was inspired by the Devil's Rejects. But a lot of what happens in Leatherface, of you have criminals that were taken from their homes, they've been locked away, they escape, they go on the run, you know, create a massacre, like a Southern Fried Massacre road trip. Yeah. Which Devil's Rejects and Three from Hell are very much like that. because I believe the easy answer would have probably been Texas Chainsaw 2, but I thought might as well throw in a little curve.
I thought Leatherface was brilliant. I thought that was a brilliant film. I'm a big fan of that whole franchise, except for Texas Chainsaw 3D, which, funny enough, I thought stole from Devil's Rejects so heavily. The opening scene is the exact same scene as Devil's Rejects.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, and yeah, Leatherface, that's brilliant. I agree wholeheartedly. Wow, good one.
Yeah, I haven't seen Leatherface, but I knew that the Texas Chainsaw, you know, series was going to come up at some point in this conversation. I mean, it's like you said, it is one of those situations where, and this has been happening a lot lately on the show, where we end up looking back at something that in itself was inspired by previous entries in the series, and, you know, that cycle continues.
I went to go see that movie. I was the only person in the theater, and they forgot to turn the lights down when the movie started, and I was like, I'll wait for like a boring part toward the beginning, you know, like in the first few minutes to like run out there, and like 20 minutes in, I was like, there's not going to be a boring part. I need to just bite the bullet and miss 15 seconds. that's a great movie.
I enjoyed it. I do enjoy the Texas Chainsaw movies to a degree. I'm not a huge fan of the Michael Bay ones because they just feel like every other 2000 slasher movie out there.
Ooh. I rewatched the beginning, man. I actually think that the beginning, I always joke with my friends that if I ever win an Oscar one day, that I'll use my leverage to remake Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the beginning, because with the exact same script. That's a brilliant movie, very thematically driven. We could talk on that later, though. Sorry, I'm talking so much.
You know what? I enjoyed it, but again, you know, it's so difficult to do a prequel when you kind of know what the outcome is going to eventually be.
Right, sure.
And you know what? The one thing I will say about the first remake, the Michael Bay remake, is Daniel Pearl, who was the director of photography of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, did an excellent job on the Michael Bay produced reboot. Pretty much the only good thing I could say about that, in my opinion, the only good thing I could say about it was the cinematography. But
well, Jonathan Liebsman, who directed the second film, he's like Michael Bay's kind of like protege. I think he's a very good director, but I don't think that he thinks thematically. And like you said, when you're making a prequel, you already know what happens in the plot, right?
Yeah.
So for a prequel to be interesting, it has to be thematically driven. And that movie really is. Like, it's all about America creating its own idea of what modern horror is. And then instead of actually doing something about it, just celebrated it by creating serial killer characters. I mean, there's a lot going on. But I don't think that Liebsman saw that. I think he just came at it from a good directing standpoint. So I think the directing and the writing are totally in conflict with each other, both of equal quality, but they don't gel together. And that's where the conflict in the movie is. And that's why I want to remake it.
which is correct, because when you have a Jonathan Liebsman, who the term I would use would be journeyman, like a Rennie Harlan. Mm-hmm. You know what? They put fun stuff up there, but they're not really trying to bring out the bigger themes.
Right, right. Yes. Yes, I agree. That's why we need people like Rob Zombie.
Well, Joe, what do you got for your first one?
Oh, because I haven't talked enough. I'm so sorry. I'm gonna take a the first one. I mean, I kind of wanted to go in soft with a little bit. I was gonna say Mad Max, the first Mad Max, specifically because I think that that's a movie about a world that is kind of like losing its mind, and like that's why even the lawmen themselves are kind of losing their minds. Like, they just have no idea how to contain this widespread like evil in people's hearts, you know? And I feel that that's kind of what happens in this movie. That like, once, you know, once they get out there, they're just like, wow, like everyone is just so like fucked. You know what I mean? Like, everybody is so fucked up.
Yeah.
That like, we might as well just go to Mexico. And then they go to Mexico and they're just bored. You know what I mean? Because like, there's almost nothing special about them anymore. It's all too easy for them. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no innocence left to ruin. And are they responsible for ruining that innocence in the first place? And I think that that's the same thing for Mad Max. I think that Mad Max is about people just giving up on the fact that the world has lost its mind, much like these characters.
Yeah, everything is so crazy. It's like, what do you even like gauge crazy by anymore?
Exactly.
Yeah. No, it's so a good
then
one.
Then the film tries to go back to what the root of America is, and you've got the Native American imagery mixed with them going to Mexico. And I'm just saying.
Nice. I like it. I like it a lot. I'm going to go with my first puzzle piece. And I should say up front, I only have a couple. You know, I knew you guys were going to bring quite a bit, being big Rob Zombie fans and horror fans. So I only have a couple for this one, but I'll work my way into the conversation. But my first one is basically going to be really the trilogy of Robert Rodriguez films, El Mariachi, Desperado, and Once Upon a Time in Mexico. And I guess you could also throw Machete in there as well. But
and Machete Kills.
And yes, Machete and in Machete Space Kills. Whenever it comes out.
When it, let's hope it comes out. Oh, absolutely. But yeah, no, this movie all kind of just builds towards that huge, you know, standoff climax, and it's absolutely it feels like an action sequence that is made by somebody who loves those movies so damn much and wants to like almost set up his own playground version of that kind of a moment and that kind of a movie. And you know, it seems like Rob Zombie is just having so much fun with that whole idea and that whole setup.
I couldn't agree more.
I love that he took it to that direction, because I mean, you know, it leads to so much great humor and of course so much great violence.
Great violence. Oh yep. Boy.
Absolutely. I know we're not supposed to like violence anymore, but you know.
Well, there's a difference between violence and like, well, I that brings up a whole different question. Like, what is violence and what is dramatic catharsis? You know, what is entertainment?
Sure.
You know what I mean? And I think that a lot of films mistake one for the other. And I think one of the beautiful things about Rob Zombie is that he's very good at drawing the line of what he's like in Halloween 2, the violence is violence and it's supposed to be repugnant and scary and awful. And sure. In this is catharsis. Mm. You know what I mean? It is very different.
Absolutely. No, I get that completely. Well, Adam, what do you got next?
You know what? I'm going to skip ahead. I'm going to ride on your coattails a little bit since you already brought up Robert Rodriguez. And since we're on the subject of violence and entertainment, these movies are essentially just, they're grindhouse movies. They're exploitation movies. They're popcorn movies to have a good time. You know what? You're there to root for the anti-hero, you know, and have a good time, see some violence and, you know, call it a night. So the grindhouse movies, Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino's grindhouse movies, because this movie wants to be a grindhouse film. It wants to go back to the 70s. It wants you to find the dirtiest, most rat-infested, piss-smelling theater that you could find with blown-out speakers and graffiti on the wall. Sit there, have some popcorn, and have a great time.
Absolutely. And, of course, Rob Zombie was part of that whole thing.
Oh, yes. That's the film I want to see more than either the two films we got or any of the other trailers.
I mean, listen, I think we all agree that Nick Cage is amazing, and who doesn't want to see him as Fu Manchu for 90 minutes?
Mm-hmm. You've got my money already. So
I just hope he grows 100%. Out that mustache and not gets a glue on. I just want to see him grow that out, and then, you know, maybe he'll do another crazy film and, you know, they'll just try to CGI his mustache out.
Yeah. Well, no, and to your puzzle piece though, I absolutely agree. I mean, you know, that's kind of, I think, Rob Zombie's, you know, his aesthetic really just completely fits into that whole thing. He's been doing it for a long time, and I think even back to his music and everything. I mean, it's always been fitting into that whole mold.
And all of his movies really do fall into one or another type of 70s exploitation films. Lords of Salem is definitely, you know, very Rosemary's Baby and The Omen type of, you know, spiritual fright fest. And, you know, a lot of the other things are a type of exploitation films that I'll get to later on my list. So I don't want to spoil it. But there's a whole series of these type of movies that I didn't realize that there was actually a name for. Until doing the research for this.
Interesting. Good tease for later.
Yeah, I've always thought of 31 as being his only movie that didn't feel 70s influence, even though it's set in the 70s. That feels much more like an 80s film to me. That one also just feels more like an action movie to me in general, like a fight for survival kind of movie.
See, that's probably the one movie that he made that I just don't like on any level, because it just seems like he is cannibalizing his own movies to make another movie.
Oh, see, the first time I saw that movie, this is a true story. Somebody asked me to be in one of their films, and I went to go do my scene the day that played in theaters. And I was like, I have to leave right from set to go to this movie. And in the scene, I got stabbed with the screwdriver, and the guy accidentally really stabbed me. And I didn't have time to go to the doctor beforehand. So I literally just like taped a paper towel on my back and went to the movie. And then there were no seats left except in the front row. So I had to stand off to the side, and I watched the whole thing standing up off to the side. And I guess I was distracted, and I was like, I don't know. It was kind of cool, but it was nothing. It was like a nothing movie. There was no, it just, you know, happened. But then the next day, you know, I started thinking about all of it. And of all his thematically driven movies, that's the most incredible. I mean, it's about, at the time, it's about everything that's going on. This idea of like aristocrats like playing games with us and like pitting us against each other when all we want to do is eat and fuck, but instead they're making us eat each other and fuck each other over. And then by the time they're done playing their games with us, we're so fed up and so driven crazy, we'd rather fight each other than fight them and take them. It's brilliant.
You know what?
Joe finds the themes in these movies, man.
He found way more in that movie than I thought that I found. But Joe, I have to applaud your dedication. I can't imagine that the first thing I want to do after getting stabbed with the screwdriver is to go to the movies and to sit and actually think about all the themes.
It was only playing one night. Like, I'm not going to miss it. You know, like, I don't know. I was going to say it wasn't that bad of a stab, but no, it was.
Are you gonna get shot and be like, you know what, I can't miss the Joker, it's gonna be the last night in the theaters?
No, that's okay. I regret sitting down for 5 minutes of the Joker. That's a different story.
That's another story altogether.
Yeah, I worked with E.G. Daily right after she did 31. We made a film together. She was in 31. She played Sex Head. And I spent the whole day on set with her between takes, just making her tell me stories about working with Rob Zombie. And she's nice. Like, you know, I've worked with like Tim Burton. And I'm like, yeah. Tell me about Rob.
See, I remember E.G. Daily from doing a lot of voiceover work. Baby Blues was one of the cartoons that I enjoyed on Adult Swim. So I know her, you know, mostly from her voice work.
Yeah, she's one of the most incredible people I know. She's been in a couple of my films, and she might be the love of my life. We'll see.
Well, what do you got next, Joe?
Next one I had was Easy Rider. Mm. And the reason I mentioned Easy Rider, because I feel like, you know, yes, The Devil's Rejects was more of like a murderous kind of road movie. This one, though, this one had that, I mean, this is an overused phrase these days, but that hangout kind of quality. I didn't feel any tension watching this movie. I literally felt like they were just doing their thing, like trying to get back into the world, looking for what their version of America is, you know? I also felt like the way it was structured, how like we were just kind of introduced to all these eccentric characters who kind of like come and go on the journey. Who, you know what I mean? Like, and I felt the performances were very flamboyant, like Easy Rider, like Richard Edson. He's so brilliant in this movie. He's, you know, of course from like Do the Right Thing and stuff like that, but we've never seen him play a character like this, you know, Mexican pimp kind of, I don't know like what he was supposed to be, but he reminded me of Jack Nicholson a lot in the movie, how they're like an instigator. They're like the person who seems like they're on your side, but really they take things too far and like ruin everything, you know, much like Jack Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess Easy Rider would be my next one.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I can see that. And like you said, I mean, it is kind of a like a hangout type of a movie. I mean, it's like all these people haven't seen each other in forever. We haven't seen them forever. And we get to see them hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Devil's Rejects is like I don't think you're quote unquote supposed to root for them necessarily in the Devil's Rejects because they're pretty evil. Like very openly evil. And then at the end, they kind of flip that on you with the end sequence. I think that that's why that end sequence is so powerful.
Right. Well, I always thought it was a little closer to the original Last House on the Left, where it's you have these evil beings and then you have these people that are going after them and you're trying to decide, well, who is really more evil? The ones that inflicted on the persons that is known to them or the vigilante justice done against them? because when you think about Sheriff Wydell, you know, trying to torture these people, you actually feel bad for the Devil's Rejects. You're actually almost rooting for the anti-heroes to get out, even though they are such evil people. But you're almost questioning, well, who's more evil?
Yeah. I think I can see where that was the idea. I guess it's just me where I was like, I didn't feel bad for them, nor did I feel anything for Wydell. Like, I was just like, I mean, that makes sense. That seems like what would happen. You know what I mean? Like,
it's definitely a movie that's going to read differently depending on how, you know, you personally are going to connect with these people.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. And again, I hope I don't make it seem like I don't like The Devil's Rejects. Yeah, I mean, of course I do. It's a good movie, but I don't think it has the same strength that all of his other work does.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to go with my next puzzle piece. And I am going to talk about not Rob Zombie's Halloween, but the Danny McBride, Jodie Hill Halloween from last year. And the
Gordon Green.
I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely. Take that back.
Well, those three men are brilliant, so it's
easy. I know. Yeah. The David Gordon Green Halloween.
Halloween H4O.
Yes, that one.
That's a good title.
This movie's so powerful, it just ripped off the seventh Halloween movie.
Yeah.
Much to a damn T.
Well, the reason I wanted to bring it up is because I felt in a lot of ways this Three from Hell, I felt in a lot of ways that Halloween felt almost like a glorified fan film. In that it was like going back, taking these characters and just like, you know, as a fan, doing what you want with them. And I feel in a way Rob Zombie is just like pulling these characters back out of, you know, they've been gone for all these years. And it's like, is this really where it would have went? You know, but it's like, well, I think this is what I want to see them do. And I think this is what, you know, a lot of my fans want to see them do. Not narratively, but just like for the fuck of it, for fun. And that's kind of what I was picturing during the movie and why I brought up Halloween.
You know what? If it wasn't for that movie, I would have no clue what a banh mi sandwich is. thank you, David Gordon Green, for explaining that to me in the middle of a Halloween movie. What I needed to know.
I saw that Halloween movie months and months and months before it came out, and it had a different ending where like Jamie Lee Curtis got shot with a crossbow and like died in the back of a pickup truck. It was very strange. I thought that movie was an embarrassment. I thought it was crap. And it's so funny because I love David Gordon Green and Danny McBride and Jodie Hill so much.
Yeah.
I actually just made a shirt the other day that said, God bless the righteous gemstones.
Hell yeah.
But
I'll order one.
It's all yours. But that movie, like, to me, felt like a paycheck movie. Like every one of them, they needed a hit so that they could keep doing the kind of things that they wanted to do. Mm. And that's what that movie felt like to me. That movie was so lazy and so dumb. Like, and you mentioned Halloween H4O. Halloween H2O, I've seen all the Halloween movies. I've only finished three of them because I think I'm just not into them. But I loved Halloween H2O, and I loved the flip in the switch with Laurie going on the hunt at the end. I thought it was awesome.
Like, which was completely missing from H4O.
Right. Well, in this one, she's been training for 40 years for this, and she like has her house all prepped out. And you're going to sit there and tell me that she doesn't have a button in her panic room, that she doesn't have cameras in each room so she can see what room he's in. And then if she has those stupid trap doors, she can't operate that from the fucking panic room? Like, get out of here. That movie's so dumb.
I've argued about this movie. It's not the worst one. It's not unwatchable. And there are things about it I do like. I love the score. I think the cinematography is also really nice. I like, they did make Michael actually very creepy at times, and I did enjoy that. But man, some of the dialogue bits. I mean, you have the androgynous boy talking with his father about not wanting to go hunting anymore because he wants to do dance class. What is the point of making a progressive joke in the middle of this movie?
There's a lot of weird moments.
And then you also introduce these characters that serve no purpose, and they're either dropped or they're dispatched of immediately. Like Will Patton. What? Why do you hire Will Patton for this?
Well, you know what, David, though? By making this a puzzle piece, it brings up an interesting thing. When good filmmakers kind of take it easy or like what is taking it easy versus being lazy, right? Mm-hmm. So like you've got David Gordon Green, who is a proven really great filmmaker, and Danny McBride, sure, who's a great writer, and they made this movie and it's just kind of lazy, but they're good at what they do. So naturally there is good there's quality to the movie, which is why we get so confused. And I think that, like, honestly, to talk about the Joker for a half second, I actually felt that way about Joaquin Phoenix in the Joker, where I actually don't think his performance is all that like amazing. He's just a great actor. It kind of felt like a great actor phoning in a performance. It didn't feel ever connected to me, but because it's Joaquin Phoenix, it's going to be a good performance. Right.
Right.
So, but then you've got Three from Hell, which I do think this is Rob kind of like it on in easy mode, just on easy street, just kind of doing his thing, but it's good. It's the difference between easy versus lazy, you know?
You know, that reminds me, when I saw it, I'm assuming when you guys saw it, they also showed the, like the little interview with Rob Zombie before it. And, he tells a story. They didn't show it for you.
No, so yeah,
he tells a story of how it came about, and the story, in a nutshell, is we went to a hotel room, we wrote a script, and then we filmed it. And my friend Josh turns to me and goes, "What a fascinating story!" Like, and I really feel like it's just like it's just a movie. Like it's just they wanted to just get together and have fun. Like, you know, there's not that much to it.
I hope that the next Halloween sequels are like Rob Zombie's Halloween 2. You've already told the stuff that needs to be told or retold. Now go off and do your own thing.
I'm glad that we've recorded that so that somebody else said it other than me and we have evidence of it, because, yes, I agree wholeheartedly.
I actually do like Halloween 2 a lot just for the chances that it takes, and because it's very different versus the first Halloween, Rob Zombie Halloween movie, I just call fun trash.
Well,
it's entertaining to watch, but I don't really think about it.
Well, he got the job based on a pitch that he wanted to make the film entirely a prequel that ended with Michael Myers killing his family, which was the beginning of the first one. And then, like, less than a month out of production, they said, nope, like, and switched it on him and gave him that as act one. So he did what he could with it, I suppose. But Halloween 2, again, he said, leave me alone. And I think it was so radical that like people really rejected it when it came out. But it's actually become a thing in the last couple of years where that film has been reevaluated and people are actually much more open to it these days.
It does feel
well. You have
way,
to watch the longer version because there's a lot more character to it and it makes a lot more sense.
The second one, right?
Yeah, the second one. And you say that they left him alone. If you actually listen to the commentary of Halloween 2, they did not leave him alone. They busted his chops just as much as they did the first time.
Right, but that's why he got his director's cut. And when I guess I should clarify that that's what I mean when I speak of Halloween 2, I speak of the director's cut.
Yeah, okay.
Like that he got to like make the version he wanted. He didn't want to fight that battle the second time. But when it came to scripting it and casting it and making his cut, he got like kind of total freedom on it. And it shows. I mean, I will never forget being in the theater seeing Halloween 2, and at the end when the helicopters are flying around and like and Loomis is like going into the shed, he's like, "Sheriff, I owe you this." The film fucked up, and suddenly the top of the image was on the bottom and the bottom was on the top. It wasn't upside down, it was like fucked up, and the rest of the movie played like that, and none of us got up. We were so in it that nobody got out of their seats. And after it was over, we left the theater and they were handing out readmit tickets. And me and my girlfriend, they handed us readmit tickets. And I looked at her and I gave her this look and she knew what it meant. And we turned right back around and watched it again.
Hell yeah.
That's a good girl. That's a keeper.
Oh, yeah. We broke up a long time ago.
Sorry about that.
That's all right.
She was a keeper. and then after that movie, she was like, "I'm never seeing another Rob Zombie movie again." You're like, "Get out."
Oh, really? It's like you were there. That's good.
Well, what do you got next, Adam?
Ooh, okay. Natural Born Killers. Just for the sensationalizing on a Manson-like level, as they did in the beginning of the movie and about halfway through of Natural Born Killers, that they sensationalize the killer. They show there's a fan base out there very similar to, you know, after the Manson family murders and during the Manson trial, that it was a whole big news circus. So I felt that fit in right there, that, you know what, you're taking a page out of that. probably really taken a page from the Manson family trials, but you know, sure. That was also replicated in Natural Born Killers. So I thought of that, especially within the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie.
Yeah, that absolutely makes sense. And yeah, I would say, you know, especially with Rob Zombie's equal, you know, infatuation with, you know, all things real life, you know, murder, he probably was just as much the real Manson as much as the, you know, the fictionalized version.
As well as there's a lot of, you know, experimental editing things, you know, very grainy shots, the lighting, you know, very similar to some of what Oliver Stone was trying to do in Natural Born Killers as well.
Absolutely.
I really, really hate Natural Born Killers. To me, that might be my least favorite movie of all time. And it's not that it's a bad movie. Of course not. It's a very well-made movie. But I do think that that film does glorify evil. And I think that I was actually just talking about this with somebody before we recorded this podcast, how Natural Born Killers, if anything, like the new Joker film, makes a case to validate your anger and your resentments at the very least, if not your violent tendencies, by rewarding Mallory and Mickey at the end. They literally become famous and have a family and travel the country in celebration. And I find that to be very troubling. And why I think that this film differs is because, first of all, the lawman in the film, Jeff Daniel Phillips, who does not get enough credit as an actor, I think he's an incredible actor. While they do paint him as a hypocrite, they do paint him as a bit debaucherous. When it gets down to the wire, he's a human. And that becomes more and more evident as the film goes on. And he's the one who kills his own wife on accident. You know, he accidentally shoots his own wife, right? Mm-hmm. In Natural Born Killers, Tommy Lee Jones is literally a snarling, evil, sinister, whatever. My problem with films like Joker, with films like Natural Born Killers, is that everybody surrounding them is an asshole. Like, they're not hypocrites, they're not whatever, they're assholes, they're evil. They're just as evil as the main characters, if not more so. And Rob Zombie, I think, really did a good job of not doing that. And as far as making them cool, the Devil's Rejects in this film, they're never cool until their showdown with the cartel, with the, you know what I mean, with the bad guys at the end. That's when the movie gets cool, when it's literally true evil versus true evil. You know what right. I mean? That's when they're playing their games. That's the only time we're meant to, quote unquote, root for them, but never in the context of the real world. And I think that's very important. I think it's a very important distinction.
I think real world is a good, interesting word to use there, phrase, but you know, because it is, it's almost like cartoonishly bad, violent, you know, mm-hmm. evil. Yeah.
I mean, Natural Born Killers is an okay movie. I don't particularly love it, but it is an interesting examination on pretty much the media-driven circus of true crime America. You know, essentially, how do we view, you know, from the eyes, we're watching all this stuff on the media and how it's sensationalized and how it makes us think. And that's essentially what Natural Born Killers is. It's trying to paint this picture through various different medias.
Right. But I think that I, Tonya is another film that does the same thing. But I think that both those films commit the same sin, which is by sensationalizing these characters and exploiting it for entertainment's sake, they are the problem that they claim. Like, they claim this is a problem, but they are part of that problem by creating iconic heroes who succeed in the end. You know, unlike Scarface, where he, you know, gets killed, or unlike Badlands, where he gets arrested, and, you know, these guys literally end in victory. So guess what? Every teenager watching the movie gets to talk about the badass soundtrack, and they get their Ian Mallory patch on their shirt, you know? and there's nothing in the film that you can point to say, yeah, but they're saying this is bad. You know what I mean? Like, they're saying that this is not the way to live.
I think it also doesn't help that there was an original ending where Mickey and Mallory were killed. Which may have helped the catharsis to it, the fact that they did get their comeuppance at the end instead of them just kind of, you know, riding off into the sunset.
Right. I felt the same way about Joker. He literally dances off into the sunset.
No!
It's kind of a perfect ending. But... so what do you got next?
I should have put my fingers in my ears. I should have went, la, 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 la.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
No, I have.
Oh, we'll lead with that, my friend.
Sorry, Adam.
Sorry.
It's an origin story. I mean, come on.
Yeah, you already know what's going to happen.
Yes, but I'm sure there's always going to be, you know, if it's ambiguous or not ambiguous, and please don't spoil the question or spoil, sure, you know, what it is, you know, but I'm interested to see how it unfolds.
I am more than absolutely happy to not talk about Joker.
That's all right. Before you got on the call, I saw Rambo. I gave Dave my few minute speech on it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, it's fine.
I don't know what I was on that night when I wrote that review. I assume you saw that review that I wrote on Rambo.
It was way more entertaining than the movie, I thought.
Well,
somebody
accused me of, like, I call out Nicholas, what's his name, Craig Zoller's films rather all the time for being racist and pro-Trump. And one of my friends, he's like, you dare call Zoller pro-Trump, but you support that pro-Trump piece of shit movie. And I was like, I could explain. And he's like, by all means. And so I just started typing. And then I just got into it, you know, and 2 hours later, I had a 10-page analysis.
You should be on a podcast, man.
Was that my 10-page analysis or was I agreeing with you? I actually don't think Craig Zellner's films are pro-Trump, but that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, I mean, we could get into that for another podcast too, but I'd rather just never watch a Craig Zoller movie again. I think that's where I'm leaning at this point.
I like
special episode coming soon.
Oh Lord, let's not invite Chad on that one.
So you got one Snyder more cut? Right, Joe?
That was good. Yeah, I have one more puzzle piece, and this is this one's loony, but it makes sense to me. Love Streams, the Cassavetes film, John Cassavetes film.
I've never heard of it. I mean, I've never seen it. I've heard of it. Never heard of it.
Yeah.
Never seen it though.
I mean, I feel like I draw a lot of films. I relate a lot of films to Cassavetes' work, but I feel it's important. This film, I talked about earlier in the podcast here how I felt like this movie was more about Rob Zombie thinking about himself. And the characters themselves start to question their relevance, like if they even should, quote unquote, keep going, what good would it do? Also asking themselves, was it worth it for us to escape from this prison life that we were in? And then to be questioning the lengths that they go to, like Baby herself, like getting to be more and more involved in her own head, like going crazier, like Otis is afraid of that. You know, I felt like this film was Rob Zombie asking all these questions. I mean, he's getting older. He's 50 now. You know, he's 53 or 54, right? You know, so he's getting older. He's starting to question, does he still have, much like Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, this idea, do I still have what it takes? Am I still relevant? Have I gone too far in a direction to be accessible and have impact? And he explores that through these characters, much like Cassavetes' Love Streams, which Cassavetes made when he was dying. He found out he was dying, so he made the film, and it was a film where he was not only questioning that about himself, but questioning the sanity of his characters and if they had helped people to have a better understanding of themselves. Because before he died, he wanted to know that he had helped people feel better and more open and learn to love each other. Even in painful ways, he wanted to be sure that that's what he was leaving behind. And I think that Rob Zombie getting older is questioning those things in this movie. Brilliantly so, like not enough to be didactic or to bog down the journey or the fun, whatever word you want to use. But I felt that those themes were very evident in this movie.
I forget. Did you bring up that movie in our Once Upon a Time in Hollywood episode?
I brought up a Cassavetes film. I don't believe
it was that one.
I believe it was Opening Night. I can't remember. I've brought up Opening Night before too, for sure.
Sure, sure. Right on. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, those themes definitely, I can see where you're coming from, even though I haven't seen that movie. But I do think that that's some of the most interesting stuff in this movie, even though I didn't like it as much as you guys seem to have. But I like that stuff about the characters, like really not sure, you know, what they even want to do with their newfound freedom, you know, after finally getting out after all these years. They're like, is this what we really even want anymore? You know, and it's such a kind of a funny, but also kind of, I guess, poignant look, at, especially with such weird characters to do it with.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Well, and for them, like the media, like catching, like the media is still sensationalizing them, and they're so bored. They're like, this is just our lives.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I got to assume that for an artist, especially one like Rob Zombie, like by the time he got famous, you got to remember there's already 30 years worth of him being who he is. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just when we're all discovering him, he's already been this for half a century, sure. You know? And so like that, I mean, it's such a weird spot to be in.
Yeah.
You know?
No, absolutely. Well, Adam, what do you got next?
You know what? I'm going to do one, and then I'm just going to throw in a quick one of the certain subgenre of exploitation that would fall under. Michael Henke's Funny Games.
Hmm.
If you've ever seen it, which is essentially about two, you know, well-dressed preppies that pretty much break themselves into a family's home and just enjoys this sadistic games and torture. Take a lot of glee from it. And that's essentially what these characters do. They just, in, you know, Three from Hell or The Devil's Rejects, they enjoy the sadism and the torture of their victims. They, you know, they almost get off on it. Mm-hmm. So that was the big connection that I had with that, is that it's essentially a movie of these people just enjoying the torture and pain and misery of others.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is another, it's almost like its own subgenre. I mean, like the home invasion movie.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
But do you think that this movie, more than the others, especially, like, are they finding joy out of it anymore? I think that that's a big question in the movie. I think that, like, do they enjoy it? And this is also, when you think about it, the first time where the people that they inflict harm on are people who have already inflicted harm on them.
Wait, what did Mr. Baggy Britches do to anybody?
You're talking about Clint Howard.
Yes.
Well, obviously he reminds him of his, of Captain Spaulding.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Spaulding was funny and made him laugh, you know, and eventually, you know, Baggy Britches had to pee himself.
I more so mean like the torture aspect, like when they're torturing, like the hunters, if you will, and, or who are hunting them, or when they're torturing, like when they've got the warden and his family and his wife and friends, like, and torturing the clown is for their sake. You know what I mean? I think that there's more of a, they actually have like, a purpose in this for their evil. They're angry this time. They're not just attacking innocents. You know what I mean? In their eyes, if you will.
True, but they do go through great lengths to kill and torture these people. Whereas they have the hunters, you could just kill that person and go on your merry way. You don't have to spend the time skinning off their face.
I agree.
So he had to have done it for enjoyment, and even the warden's wife, where they don't make it as apparent in The Devil's Rejects that rape had occurred, but you kind of assume that rape had occurred because she's there bruised and naked. You know, he obviously did that for a reason. You know, for enjoyment.
In Devil's Rejects?
No, in Three from Hell, you have the warden's wife to Otis that's naked. So, you know, it's more, they're trying to allude to it.
Absolutely.
Versus The Devil's Rejects, where he forcibly, you know, has her blow him and then lick the gun for sexual gratification.
Right. But again, in Devil's Rejects, these are complete unknowns. These are, in their eyes, just, you know, randoms. But in this movie, they actually have some kind of weird, sick, like, perspective that, like, these people, you know, like, while they may be enjoying it, they're targeted. These people are targeted for the wrongs that have been done to them.
Mm-hmm.
Unlike the other two films.
Well, then what about the Mexican cartel at the end? When you have Otis beating the one guy's head in with the gun, you know, Richard Brake is just sitting there smiling and enjoying it.
Right. I'm not saying they don't enjoy it, but again, the Mexican cartel, they were there to kill them. You know what I mean? They were betrayed. They were double crossed. So like, yeah, like that's interesting though. Until you brought it up though, I never thought about that. I never thought about the fact that all these people that they're against in this movie are people who have done some kind of wrong by them at first in their eyes. That's interesting.
Yeah. And then quickly, while I was looking up for films on this, I stumbled across, you know, cause I was looking at, I remember reading a review of The Devil's Rejects referring to it as a Southern fried road movie, which it is. So I found a type of subgenre, which perfectly fits, called Hicksploitation. And the definition, a regional branch of exploitation cinema populated with hillbilly and good old boy stereotypes. I think that pretty much fits at least Devil's Rejects and Three from Hell into that type of Hicksploitation, whether it be a Smokey and the Bandit, 2000 Maniacs, even you know, the original Walking Tall.
Macon, you know, County the, Line.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, just kind of that good old boy Southern, you know, they're all essentially white trash.
Right. Yeah.
So, well, I think it kind of falls into that type of genre, which you don't really see anymore.
I agree. And yeah, being Texas based, these movies, I mean, it's kind of ripe with that, I suppose. His white trash aesthetic has kind of washed over all of his films, whether they're set in like an urban city or like small suburbia. But I guess that here is where it's most appropriate for sure, especially in Devil's Rejects. Devil's Rejects, I think 100% falls into that category for sure.
Yeah, and his music has a lot of that aesthetic as well. Everything revolving around his, you know, artwork and videos and all that kind of stuff.
But I think it even carries over into his other movies, and I believe that we were all talking about last time we tried to record this, Richard Brecht in Halloween 2, where he just repeats the word fuck 50 times in various different tones.
Sure.
I mean, that's just trying to be as white trash as you can get.
I mean, I see, I think that that is one of the most like honest and realistic moments in a movie ever. Like with his face completely crushed in, pinned by that car, because he's in a car accident in the film. If people don't know, they hit a cow in their meat wagon, and he's Richard Brecht, he's pinned, and his face is cut up by glass, and he's in so much pain, and he's trying to say any word at first, and he can't get any word out except for fuck. And then he just keeps repeating it because he's manic. Did you guys know that actually the F and U together, the sound that it makes, buh, releases a kind of endorphin and it's a muscle relaxer unlike any other sound that we can make,
which that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, which is why fuck is such a used word, or even the word fun. It's the only sound that releases those feelings. And that's why we like to use it so much. Just a little tidbit.
I happen to like the word fuck more than fun, but, I mean, but you know, if you put them together, fucking fun fucking, you know, that's I feel pretty good right now.
Listen to those endorphins fly.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and do the finished puzzle here, and then we'll get into any, closing thoughts about the movie. So we talked about in this conversation about Three from Hell, we talked about Leatherface and the Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies. Mad Max, El Mariachi, Desperado, Once Upon a Time in Mexico, Machete, Robert Rodriguez movies in general, really. Grindhouse, Easy Rider, Halloween, Natural Born Killers, Love Streams, Funny Games, and Hicksploitation movies. Yeah.
Love Streams just sticks out like such a sore thumb.
I know, right? I love it. I love it.
It would have been funnier if it was like, yep, Love Story. I've been like, really? How'd you get that one in there?
I really recommend, David, I think you just need to check out some Cassavetes films, man. I think at least I'll make a lot more sense to you at that point. You'd be like,
I think I do. I think I need to do a little side series for the Patreon where I catch up on some of these damn movies that I haven't seen.
Or you could just watch more movies of the younger Cassavetes and just rewatch Face Off a few times.
Oh, Nick. Yeah. Oh, he's the best. He's such a good dude. I love The Notebook. That's true. It's true. I do. I love it. Jenna Rollins. I mean, that was my introduction to her as an actress. She was Cassavetes' wife, if you will. She was his star most of the time. It's a great introduction to the work of Cassavetes.
I love Jenna Rollins. I love James Gardner. I can't get behind that movie.
You know, I actually had the honor of filming Jenna Rollins. I directed her in her final on-screen performance. She saw a film that I made. I gave it to her because it's such a big Cassavetes fan. And she and her assistant, they hired me to direct a short film that is her last film. And we got to film it at the Cassavetes household where he shot most of his films. One of the greatest honors of my life.
Wow. Yeah. Pretty impressive.
That's freaking cool.
I mean, it was fun. I'll send you the movie.
Any closing thoughts on Three from Hell, you guys?
Well, when we tried to record this and the movie had just come out, you know, I guess we all had certain things on our mind in regards to why people weren't in the movie as much. And a few days later, unfortunately, sure. Sig Haig died. You know, we were all kind of bummed about it. And this apparently is his last movie. So, you know, rest in peace, brother. Fuck your mama. Fuck your sister. Fuck your grandma. And last of all, fuck you.
Perfect. Perfect.
That is absolutely a great closing thought.
For me, I really like that, like, you know, this conversation has brought up certain like themes that I, you know, that I hadn't even started to explore yet, you know, like we just mentioned the idea that these characters are the first time that they've inflicted violence on characters who they felt had wronged them, just different ideas, and kind of what you did, David, when you were talking about, you know, Halloween and how that related to like filmmakers taking it easy and filmmakers being lazy. That's an interesting sure. thought too. So I'm very appreciative of this conversation. I actually, it's more, even more to chew on when I go back and see it for a fourth time. Yay.
Yeah. Which was the last thing I was going to bring up is just the fact that, like I said at the beginning, you know, this episode is going up the day that this is, having an encore, Fathom event screening. That's pretty rare that a movie gets, you know, put out in theaters for only, you know, one or two nights and then actually does so well that they put it out for another one.
It only made it made $2 million in those three nights. $2 million.
Yeah.
On a $3 million budget.
Oh, God bless him. I remember when I saw It Follows for the first time, I was just like, man, that movie was terrible, but good for them for like breaking through with this little, like, what was that budget? $100,000. And then I find out that it was a $3 million movie, and I was like, what? What? That cost $3 million? Rob Zombie's Lords of Salem cost a third of that and is the most beautiful, big, epic-looking, you know, this man can do so much with so little, and it's because he cares about his movies, and his focus is in the right place, if you ask me.
I liked It Follows.
You know, I'm just, but from the music video background, he, you know, has the ability to shoot on a small budget, on a shortened schedule. He's used to doing that just from his music video background.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least I seem to think so. And, well, then, you know, and you don't want to talk about Joker. I don't want to talk about It Follows.
Yeah, good. I'm very good with both. Yeah, let's not talk about either of those movies.
No, It Follows is exactly like the allegory it was. It's a painful STD that follows you everywhere.
Yeah, but it has absolutely nothing to do with, like, you know, sexual exploration of teenagers coming to your own sexual. I mean, like, the movie is about STDs and has nothing to do with sex. It has nothing to say. What? How stupid to take such a great premise and say nothing with it. To hell with you.
I agree. Go watch Ginger Snaps instead. Movie that has a lot more to say.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Ginger Snaps.
That's great movie.
That's a good trilogy.
Well, Joe, do you got anything you want to plug?
No, but I do have some exciting things that are on the cusp that hopefully next time I'm on here, I can share with everybody. Very exciting. So
beautiful.
Yeah, just wish me well for now.
Yes. Good luck with all of those things. How about you, Adam? Anything you want to plug?
Nothing to plug, but support your local video store. Oh, wait. No, we don't do that anymore.
If you've got one, do it.
Yeah, though. If you got one, go to Alaska.
My name is Toby. I'm one of the hosts of the Secret Transmission Podcast. We do a satire show all about conspiracies, UFOs, the paranormal, cryptozoology, true crime, and much more. Our show was transmitted to Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, TuneIn Radio, and many other podcast apps.
You can follow us on Instagram and Twitter at
Secret Transpod. We hope you
come listen to us
try to explain the unexplainable.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Three from Hell with Joe Black and Adam Wells. Really fun time talking to those guys, and fun movie. I mean, it's you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the Rob Zombie thing, but I definitely enjoyed this one. I think it might have been my favorite of his movies, the more I think about it. But, you know, I still didn't love it or anything, but definitely go see it it is out tonight if you're hearing this. Of course, we got into spoilers on the episode, as we always do, but, you know, that doesn't mean you shouldn't go see it. Go see the movie. It's out tonight, Fathom Events. Check it out. And, of course, it'll be on VOD later this week, I believe. So that does it for today. I want to remind you, as always, to make sure you are subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. You can rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Piecing Pod. Join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces. Support our Patreon at patreon.com/piecingpod. And, I don't know, buy t-shirts at TeePublic. Search for Piecing Pod. I don't know. There's a whole bunch of stuff you could do. Go do it. Best of all, just share the show and let us know how you're enjoying it. We'd love to hear from you. So, yeah, that's it for today, but we have a lot of Piecing It Together coming up real soon here. The episodes may be a little bit sporadic over the next week or two. I got some stuff I'm dealing with at home, but we'll get into that another day. But just know that we have like 5 episodes in the can right now, and they are coming, and we got a whole lot of other movies to cover too. So we got plenty more Piecing It Together coming your way in the next couple of weeks here. And let's leave you guys with a piece of music, as we always do. And of course, I want to try to find something that would feel at home in a movie like Three from Hell, or really any Rob Zombie movie. And I'm going to go with the track that I know I've played before on the show, but it definitely would fit. And that is Burnout from my album Head Like Fire. Enjoy this track, and we'll be back with more Piecing It Together coming up later this week.
And all points west.